Thanks for listening to Other People's Flowers. If you'd like to have your work featured in the program, please send it to editor@otherpeoplesflowers.com. We hope you enjoy this episode.
Inscription by Dorothy Pierce. 2nd of May 2011. Montrose Manor. Darling George, I hope this will bring as much pleasure as Wilde. I look forward to your inevitable critique. You have an unstoppable talent. Keep feeding it through reading it. With love, Florence. XXX. I found the above in the front cover of a copy of The Vagrant Mood by W. Somerset Maugham. It was written with a fountain pen, in a kind of spidery, spiraling hand. As limited as my powers of graphology were, I could deduce that either the author were dyslexic or not one for writing. My own handwriting was chabby, but I wasn't a dyslexic. Perhaps Florence was one of those people more inspired by mathematics than the humanities. Perhaps she would attend handwriting classes when she was at school. I certainly had, or perhaps not. I don't know why I decided to discover who Florence and George were. Perhaps it was because the book had been abandoned to a second-hand bookshop. After all, aren't books given to you by someone else special? Aren't they made even more special by a few lines scrawled in the front cover? Who gave away a book with an inscription? Only people who'd been torn apart would give something like that away. Only people wanting to forget would toss away their inscriptions. My first deduction, as cliché as it was to imagine the two of them as lovers. Montrose Manor was an English country house. The birds were chirping, insects buzz, among a meadow of purple and yellow wildflowers. Long grasses swaying in a gentle spring breeze, an ash, all twisted and broken by years of wind standing in a field. And George and Florence walked hand in hand down an overgrown footpath, cowslips lining either side, stopping every few steps to kiss and embrace. Young lovers, hopeful for the future. They stopped under a leafy oak to have sex, their faces rest in repose afterwards. It would never end. Then maybe George was a soldier, called out to fight in Iraq, IED by the side of the road, him and his troop all in bits. Florence weeping as soon as the two uniformed men showed up, shutting the door on them, as if closing it would let her believe George was alive for a few moments longer. But he couldn't have gone to Iraq. The inscription was dated in 2011, and soldiers only turn up on your doorstep in Hollywood films. In all my fantasies of other people's relationships, the lovers are young, past a certain age, it seems. Lovers cannot exist. Hollywood has made sure of that. I only want young love, youthful passion, not old love, not what might be true love. I'm only interested in the possibility of loss, of youthful dreams and illusions being shattered. I was wandering the melancholic streets of Bloomsbury a lot when imagining Florence and George. If my death in Iraq story was true, I assume George's broken mother had walked the same streets carrying a box of her son's old books to donate to the charity store. The roads in and around Bloomsbury provide little oases of peace in the chaos. Coram Fields, Marchmont Street, Russell Square, they're all empty at the weekends, and with a glisten of rain on the pavements, there's no better place to walk and to remember. Mostly, I remember my own broken relationships when walking through there, cafes in which a girl told me it wasn't working, an HSBC bank outside of which, on an icy January day, Leonora told me she loved me, only to be let down. I seem to let them all down. But my initial dream of Florence and George was too easy, too fake, too film-like. I wanted to hold reality. Enough of fictions and delusion. It was a lonely time for me. I need something real to cling to. My first investigation was to look up Montrose Manor on the internet. My discovery was not what I anticipated at all. I was expecting to find an address on Google Maps for some old manor house in Gloucestershire, to Shropshire, or somewhere equally idyllic like that. Hops growing by the side of the road, getting on the donkey and trapped at the weekend. Memories of my early childhood, really. Instead, the first and only listing I can find was for a Montrose Manor in Cape Town. It was a recovery clinic for people with eating disorders. They also treated alcohol and drug addiction. Apparently, it was world-renowned. If you had the money, you might send your son or your daughter there to be patched up, ready to face the madness and insanity of modernity again. Florence must have been anorexic or bulimic. My prejudice wouldn't allow her to be obese. So this book was sent from inside the walls of the clinic. Had someone visited her and given it to her? And she had passed it along? She must have taken it along with her from England so she could read it before sending it to her beloved. Each day, she would wake early, the South African sunlight beaming through her window. The sterile room made her feel nauseous. The plain white walls, the cold aluminium desk, the long-worn linoleum floor, the way the starched sheets scraped against her cheeks as she slept. But she was doing it all for George, she told herself. Once she started to put some weight on again, he would love her again. And he did love her. He always had. He had stood by her when her weight had sunk to dangerous levels. He had accompanied her. He had accompanied her to the bathroom after each meal to make sure she wasn't putting her fingers down her throat. He would always be there for her. It was only her parents that doubted they had loved each other forever. The other patients shared their woes while biting nails and rocking back and forth on their chairs. But not her. She was loved. She loved. She knew that. She knew what it was like to have someone truly care about you. After reading The Vagrant Mood, she sat down on her hard stool and wrote a short letter to George to put in the post along with the inscribed book. She sent it and dreamed of her George. George was waiting for her. George was not waiting for her. George longed for her return. George was pleased to be rid of her. George cherished The Vagrant Mood like he had cherished nothing before. George took a copy of The Vagrant Mood to a charity shop to expiate all memories of sick, broken Florence. In the morning, after she had written the letter and packed up the book to be sent, she received a phone call. They were allowed one a week. By week 4 of her 6-week program, she had received only 2. One from her mother and one from her best friend Kate. It was strange George had not rung, but then he probably didn't know what to say. Their love could not be expressed in words. She followed an orderly down the corridor to the phone booth and took the phone in her hand. The orderly stood a few meters away, staring at the wall. Hello? Florence? Kate? How are you? Fine, fine. What, you sound confused. No, I'm fine. I just thought for a second it would be George calling. Well, I am calling about George. Remember how we said I'd tell you everything when you were away so that you could be completely clean? You remember you wanted all the news, good and bad? Yes. Well, George, how do I say this? George has started seeing someone else. That girl, Caroline, remember? But Florence had already dropped the phone. The news would cause her to relapse and have to spend an additional 12 weeks in Montrose. by which time she would have long forgotten George. Then one rainy day in May, she would be digging through her old possessions, and she would come across the package book, remembering what it was. She took it to a charity shop and dropped it off, letter and all, and she could forget George and her darker days. This is all invention. Montrose could just as easily be a house in the countryside. Admittedly, I only went to page 2 of the search results. Perhaps there was more truth in the subsequent lines. George was clearly some kind of aspiring critic. He had read that Oscar Wilde Florence had sent him and offered his professional opinion. Now, he would return his critical gaze to Somerset Maugham, who would no doubt become his victim. George was one of those tiresome people who picks holes in everything. At the beginning of his and Florence's relationship, she had given him her favourite novel, A Picture of Dorian Gray, to read, and he would critique it. He told her that he didn't like Wilde, that he was too boring, too predictable. George was somewhat pompous in his critiques, and he imagined he was a man of significant intelligence. Or not! Or Florence was just so enamored, she failed to see through his pretentiousness. George had decided his life was to be spent in books. After completing his undergraduate degree in English, getting a first, of course, he immediately set about doing a master's. He was studying at UCL and hoped to complete his PhD at Oxford. He and Florence had met one summer day in Lincoln's Inn Fields, while he was reading Middlemarch. She bounced over to him and sat next to him on the cold stone bench. George Eliot, how is it? Terrified of women, gagged by his own fervent romanticism, George failed to respond. Florence did not seem put out and chatted idly about her experience reading Mill on the Floss. It's meant to be part of growing up if you're a woman. You read Mill on the Floss and it changes you somehow. Makes you understand life. It didn't help me. No one reads George Eliot anymore. And George was in love. Here was a girl who understood the true value of literature, of criticism. They kissed under a horsechestnut the following week. It was raining. The waxy leaves shone in the fading summer. The sounds of wheels splashing across the grey streets surrounded them. But in each other's arm, George felt nothing but relief. The sky turned violet as the sun descended behind the rain clouds, and they sat on a bench not caring about the rain on the coming night. But he wasn't sure if he loved Florence or Montrose more. The first time he had seen the manor house emerging like a vision of the twisting driveway, oak trees lining the final stretch, and that lone ash of the western field. He had imagined he had just stepped into Bryce Head Revisited. The house was a monster. Grey stone, sash windows, enormous grounds, art on the walls, a walled garden dripping with gooseberries, raspberries, blueberries, boysenberries, blackcurrants, redcurrants, every wild berry. And in the evening they went down to a small river and picked elderflower to turn into cordial the next day. He would always remember sitting with Florence in the swing chair, her head in his lap and the smell of late summer jasmine filling the air. If there was heaven on earth, Montrose was it. Dreams fade. Too much time with Florence, too much time in love, had distracted him from his work and he failed to get a distinction in his master's. With a lousy merit, his hopes were diminished. Oxford and Cambridge would not take him now. UCL were reluctant. There was hardly any funding for the humanities anyway, and it certainly wouldn't be given to students who only got merits. America was his only hope. Forgetting Florence, he threw himself back into his work. he didn't miss her. It was, he told himself while reading Barthes, nothing but a playing out of the lover's discourse. It ended on a February morning. He was in his poxy shared flat in Dalston, reading about trigonometry while preparing to take the GRE. Why Americans insisted on standardized testing, he didn't know. The doorbell rang, and he ignored it. But momentarily, his door cracked open, and Florence was at the door. She looked sleepless. "George, darling," she said, and sat down on his bed. They never called each other darling. It was a hideous way to express affection, and she knew it would annoy him. "Florence, I haven't seen you in a while. It's not been all that long. 3 weeks is a long time when you're in a relationship with someone." "Perhaps." "I came to say goodbye." "I know." She came over to the desk and touched her hand on his shoulder. It was cold and limp. He wanted to take it, rub it in his hands and warm it up, but it was better she just left. He would miss Montrose the most when she was gone. It was his bride's head, his Charleston. But he had to get rid of Florence now. It was too much. "I bought you this," she said as she left. "Somehow I forgot to give it to you." It was a copy of The Regan Mood. She knew he loathed Somerset Maugham. That wasn't literature. That was childish storytelling. Without reading the inside cover or flicking through it, he tossed it to the side of the room. Florence heard it thudding against the wall on her way out and sighing. True love. 6 months later, accepted into SUNY in Buffalo, he found The Regan Mood while he was emptying his room. It had fallen down the side of his bed. The cover was slightly creased. Dust was on the pages. The only books he was taking with him were in a single box. He couldn't take it. He didn't want to take it. Reminders of Florence and Montrose just made him queasy. He left it for one of his housemates, who, not being a reader, quickly dropped it off at a charity shop. 4 years later, with three to go to get his PhD, George was lonely and cold in upstate New York, dreaming of happier and easier days in England with Florence. On Facebook, he had seen she had got engaged. There was a picture of her with her fiancé in front of Montrose. The diamond glowed on her finger. She was smiling, head tossed slightly back. She seemed happy. He was glad, but also regretful. There was more to life than English literature, it seemed. But the copy of The Regan Mood I had bought did not have a creased cover or dust on the pages. In fact, it looked unread, like the only page that had been open was the front cover. There were some very pale marks on the white cover, but those could just as easily have been put there by me. In fact, most of the damage could simply have been there by my endless handling of the book. I hadn't even read it yet. Perhaps I was the first person to open the cover. Perhaps the book had never been given to George. Perhaps Florence just wrote it to make herself feel better about not being loved. I was unloved at the time of my investigation. I was often unloved. No doubt my state was what prompted me to find out about Florence and George. Could there be happy lovers in the world? I had just ended things with Leonora in January bitterness outside an HSBC in Clerkenwell. And every time I thought of her, a vacuum opened somewhere inside and threatened to suck me in. We had gone out for supper, as we always did on Wednesday. And she had been telling me about her university work. She was writing an essay about Renaissance and modern technology. Would the world be what it is today without the efforts of the greats? To me, the answer seemed childishly simple. I thought Da Vinci was not the most important figure in the Renaissance, but everyone else in the seminar obviously argued that he was. I think the world was more influenced by Machiavelli and the Medicis than by Da Vinci. We need to talk. Okay. We stopped in the street. The tiniest droplets of moisture had collected around the fur lining of her coat. Her lips were bright red. Her green eyes were lambent in the cool air. The sky was dark orange above, lit by the city lights. I had never been one for breaking up, but I went ahead anyway. It's not you, it's me.
What?
I like you. I like you a lot, but we're not in love with each other.
Aren't we?
I shook my head. She tried to kiss me, her lips brushing mine before I pulled back. I wanted to kiss her. Oh, how I wanted to kiss her. But alas, our time was over. I'm sorry, I muttered. It's okay, I understand. She turned away. The red and white sign of the HSBC Bank shone out across the street. Taking my arm, she accompanied me to Farringdon Station. My last memory of her was of her slipping her hand out from my arm, tapping her oyster on the yellow reader, and disappearing down the Hammersmith and City Line. I went into the Metropolitan Line, and that was that. What was Florence and George's last meeting like? Were there tears? Was it over before it started, like my and Leonora's? Did Florence hold her pillow at night, longing for the goose down and Egyptian cotton to transform into the wavy locks and lissom body of her once beloved? There was still the final line to consider. I had imagined George, the critic, George who didn't care, but there was still that childish last line. Keep feeding it through reading it. Did the hopeless assonance suggest a playfulness? Was Florence gently teasing George? Were they not lovers, but brother and sister? George has always been a little pretentious. The family joke, Florence always believed, was that after all the teasing and goading about his reading and critical writing, George would actually make something of himself and forget the summer days of parties and champagne in Montrose. It was the day of the annual midsummer party. The flowers were in full bloom. The front lawn was laid with tables and chairs. Their mother's rose of hibiscus was just coming into bloom. Bees darted in and around the potted plants and out to the apple orchard on the other side of the walled garden. On the other side of the walled garden, George was sitting in the Adirondack, book in hand, face shadowed by a Panama hat. "What are you reading?" asked Florence. Without taking his eyes off the page, he lifted the book to show to her. The Razor's Edge by Somerset Maugham. Florence had not read it. She read little. Life's distractions made it easier to spend arbitrary hours on Facebook, Twitter, BuzzFeed, YouTube. All those time-wasting delights post-modernity offered.
"You should try it," he said. "I'm fine. I don't have time."
"Are you looking forward to the party?" George nodded. "You don't like parties, do you?" George shook his head. "You must be the only person in the world who doesn't like parties."
"Perhaps."
He folded the book shut and put it on his lap. "What do you like, George?"
"I like books. I like silence. And I like my family." "Ha, you seriously need a girlfriend."
"Perhaps."
"I'm going to find you one tonight."
The girl Florence had in mind for George was a shy, red-haired Margaret, or Maggie, who had recently moved down to Montrose from London. Her father was an enormous, boisterous man, while her mother was stick-thin, shy and discerning, just like her daughter. Once introduced, George found her vaguely attractive. Three or four more drinks later, and they were under the sycamore round the back of the house. And George had her up against a tree, and he found he quite enjoyed kissing her. Other couples were dotted sporadically around the house and gardens, and George struggled to find somewhere to have sex with her.
Eventually, he settled on a newly ploughed field, the furrows in the mud offering some comfort. They saw each other a few times afterwards, but mostly he just found her tedious. She was needy, dependent, uninspiring, and didn't like the amount of time he spent reading. Florence was delighted, of course, but she soon lost interest and returned to pursuing her own doomed loves. In early September, just before the leaves began to fall and Monrose became a yellow and auburn daydream, George returned to university after breaking poor Maggie's heart. Florence sent him the vague mood, laughing to herself as she wrote the last line of the inscription. He had bored her earlier with his interpretation of Oscar Wilde, and she knew the subtle dig would rile him. Years later, when Maggie, which is memory, and they had both left home to pursue life's disappointments, George would pull out the unread copy from his shelf, read the inscription, and silently weep. How had life done this to him? How had he ended up living in a shared flat in Leighton and waiting tables in the evening? Was it all for independence? Montrose was sold to cover their father's drinking and gambling habits. Their parents had finally divorced a year later, and Florence and George both had the memories of their childhood and nothing else. How much happier he would have been had he not abandoned Maggie because she only wanted to have sex 3 times a week. Their father killed himself a year later, drank himself to death. He was found choked on his own vomit, a bottle of scotch half empty next to him, and 2 empty bottles of vodka on the floor beside his chair. Florence died in a car crash in Italy 6 months later. She was driving through winding Tuscan roads with her then boyfriend, now lost lover, when the car flipped and crashed her skull. Having had enough of his family, of memories, George took all of the books of his childhood and got what money he could for them at the local charity shop. On lonely nights, as every night was, he would remember the summer before it had all gone wrong and try to reclaim it, grab it in his open palm like a lost moth. Why do all my variations end in tragedy? Is it not possible that nothing happened at all? That the sole reason for returning the book was because George's bookshelf got full? It does happen. Maybe I just wanted it to end in tragedy because it made the story more interesting. Maybe Montrose was the house George and Florence still lived in. 7 months later, after the vagrant mood had been sitting neglected on my bookshelf, I noticed it while dusting the tops of my books. The top of its page had turned ash grey with dust. It was right at the top of my towering bookcase, reminding me of my initial interest. I spent some time looking up houses in England that were called Montrose Manor. I finally found one down in Devon. There were no pictures, only a address. It said it was an hour drive. As urban grey melted into suburban sprawl and vanished into rolling green, I pondered what exactly I was going to do on discovering the house. It took 2.5 hours from London. The traffic was clear. I listened to Strauss on the radio, The Metamorphosen, a rare piece for Radio 3 to be playing. Normally, it was all Bach and Beethoven and Berlioz and Brahms, imposing composers to intimidate you as you went about your day. But The Metamorphosen is masterful piece, elegiac, melancholic, raging, powerful. As profound as art goes before it tears out your soul and leaves it dashed in a rainy drain. Montrose was a small village, bloodless grey stone cottages and a small village green with leafless trees guarding each corner. Following my sat-nav, I found the manor house at the outskirts of the village. An ancient cedar of Lebanon marked the front of the driveway. A few cows sat in the grass field in front of the house. A bloated cloudburst threatened overhead. My tires crunched on the sinking gravel. It was an imposing Edwardian manor house, grey with box windows, large chimneys reaching of it, a vaulted roof. It looked oddly sad. The house looked empty. Sitting in the car, engine off, I noticed a vague light on the top of the house. I stepped out and approached the enormous wooden door and hammered the knocker. It echoed against the dull wood. A few seconds later, I pulled the doorbell. Yes? An old woman, perhaps 70, peered at me over a pair of point spectacles. Is Florence here? I should expect so. I am her. Is George here? No, he only comes in the holidays when my daughters brings him. I came to give you this. I held the book out to her, looking at it. It took a while for her to recognize what it was. She took it in her hands and turned it over a couple of times before opening the cover and read it. Oh, where did you get it? I found it in a charity shop. I see. Did I see the faintest glimmer of sadness, of regret in her eyes? Would you like a cup of tea? I won't, thank you, I said and turned away. She watched me all the way out the drive. I waved at her as I reversed and turned around. The dying embers of the sun faded into cold black darkness as I pulled the car out of the drive. Behind me, Florence remembered her grandson.
Other People's Flowers was produced by Hugo Gibson, Chris Kamonvutitam, and Hamish Adam Cairns. If you'd like to have your work featured on the show, please send it to editor@otherpeoplesflowers.com. Thank you for listening.